All right, everybody, it is 12:59 and the recording has started for today's webinar. So I'm going to get us started with some quick housekeeping rules as everybody enters the Zoom webinar window. So as I said, today's training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Cluin for those not able to join the live webinar. The Cluin training page also offers the slides available for download if you'd like to either go through them at your own pace or after the webinar. While in Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window. Please use this box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter during today's training. For questions and comments provided out loud, please hold until the designated Q&A breaks. We will attempt to get to as many questions as we can verbally. However, if there are too many questions to answer, we will ask our trainers to answer those questions directly through the Q&A window. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available at the end of the training today by completing the feedback form. The feedback form for all ITRC courses is located on the Cluin training page that brought you here today. And you just need to fill it out, click a box to certify you that participated, and then it will be emailed to you. So on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, Managed Aquifer Recharge, also known as MAR. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an overview of the associated online guidance document of the same name, Managed Aquifer Recharge, produced by ITRC in 2023. We cannot cover all of the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document today, so please visit the website and take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you work on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for active teams and learn more about how you can become a member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor produce, excuse me. The US government, we do not warranty the material or endorse any specific products. Apologies about that. On slide number four, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have been volunteer members of ITRC's MAR team throughout its life cycle and have supported the training course through its development and obviously through its live offerings. If you would like to read more about their backgrounds and expertise, their information is included on the Cluin training page that brought you here today. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to Kelsey Bufford from the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality to get us started. I'm going to launch the poll first, Kelsey, and then I'll give you
Sure.
remote control.
All right.
All right.
I'm experiencing a little bit of feedback. Okay, we're good. Thank you so much, Devin, and thank you all for attending this webinar today. Devin, you've already launched the poll, and the reason why we have this poll is because we want to understand who our audience is today. And to the audience, let me know through the poll your level of knowledge or experience concerning Managed Aquifer Recharge, or MAR, as you'll be hearing it called throughout this training. The world is facing an increase in the vulnerability and scarcity of freshwater supplies. Managed Aquifer Recharge is becoming an increasingly important method for improving and supplementing subsurface freshwater storage. MAR has the additional benefit of reducing flood risk, managing stormwater mitigation subsidence, and controlling saltwater intrusion. Devin, if we've had enough time, can we please see the results of the poll? All right, it looks like we have a great mix of people today. So you all are in the right place. That is fantastic. In the guidance document, we define managed aquifer recharge as the purposeful recharge of aquifers to increase water supplies for subsequent recovery or environmental benefit. This training is intended to help you understand MAR and its applications, recognize MAR as a process rather than simply a single technology, realize that MAR can be widely applied, and understand MAR's role in the future for addressing water supply resilience and climate impacts. Even though water rights are an integral part of the MAR process, they will not be discussed during today's training. The process and efforts required to complete an engineering feasibility study, alternatives analysis, preliminary engineering report, and engineering design with plans and specifications are beyond the scope of this internet-based training. However, these topics are covered in the guidance document. Why are we talking about managed aquifer recharge? Why is it important? Currently, the planet is experiencing wide-scale changes in its climate system. There is extreme flooding, drought, and the ever-increasing demands for human consumption of fresh water. While groundwater recharge is a natural phenomenon, MAR can be used for enhancement or restoration of recharge in environments where there is not enough water or perhaps too much water. Overall, MAR is impactful because it is a process that ensures groundwater as well as surface water resources remain dependable for generations to come. In our guidance document, the MAR process is depicted as the model on this slide. There are four key components to the MAR process. These components are represented by the individual circles surrounding the central managed aquifer recharge circle. The first component is intended use. For example, what is your water challenge? Do you have too much water? And for those of you living in California, you know what I'm talking about, or perhaps not enough. In today's training, we will talk about how the MAR process can assist with resolving these problems. The next key component is source water. During the MAR process, water is being placed into an aquifer. Where does this water come from? We will learn more about different types of source water and issues to acknowledge during this section of the training. The third component is the receiving aquifer. This is the geologic formation that is receiving the source water. What are the characteristics we need to consider regarding the receiving aquifer? These considerations will be discussed today. Finally, the last component is recharge technologies. How are we getting the source water into the receiving aquifer? There are different methods for accomplishing this, and these methods will be explored in the training. By asking these questions about the four components of MAR, do you see why the arrows are double-headed? Because the components on the model. This is because you might be starting your MAR project from any one of the four components. All right, today's training will follow the four components of managed aquifer recharge, which mimics how the guidance document is laid out with section numbers referenced. The intended use section will be covered by Linda Bowling. We will learn more about source water from Guy Sewell. The receiving aquifer has many characteristics to consider, which Adam Jansen will discuss in his section. Finally, the different technologies for recharging the aquifer will be covered today by Jeff Davis. After our first Q&A session, Guy Sewell and Adam Jansen will present two full case studies, and I will wrap up the training followed by another Q&A session. We were fortunate to be able to assemble 12 case studies from across the country that demonstrate most of the MAR processes and approaches. Like the roadmap on the last slide, each case study is listed by their corresponding section number in the guidance document, shown as sticky notes. Common feedback from ITRC webinar trainings is the need for more case studies. These real-world examples resonate with us because we can relate to the problems being resolved in different parts of the country. So, our subject matter experts will train you on the basics of the four components of managed aquifer recharge, and then at the end of each of their sections, we'll show how those concepts were utilized in the Walla Walla Basin watershed. After we cover the basics of the four components, our trainers will show how they are used from project planning through implementation in the SWIFT project in the coastal plain of Virginia and the San Antonio, Texas water system. But first, let me give you a quick introduction to the Walla Walla Basin watershed case study. This will set the stage for which Linda, Guy, Adam, and Jeff demonstrate how the components of MAR apply to this project. This watershed covers an area of dry land in the rain shadow of the Cascade Mountains, located in southeast Washington and northeast Oregon. The soils of this watershed consist of coarse sand and gravel in the alluvial areas, finer-grained glacial flour and wind-blown sediments in upland areas overlay clays, which in turn grade into volcanic rock with depth. The Walla Walla Basin watershed was experiencing several water challenges. An increase in residential and commercial development caused water levels in the Walla Walla River to drop, which degraded habitat conditions for steelhead and bull trout. Stream flows were insufficient to support aquatic life. Floodplain function was lost due to channelization and flood control. In addition, there was greater than 30% seepage loss from the river into the groundwater. It was determined that groundwater mitigation was required to achieve river restoration. Let's keep those challenges in mind as we revisit this case study throughout the entire training and see how the MAR process can help. I am now turning over our training to Linda Bowling with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to take us through the intended use section. Linda, it's all you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kelsey. Okay. Let's see, Devin, I don't think my mouse is working. Thank you. Before I talk to you specifically about managed aquifer recharge project intended use, let me set the stage of why you might want to implement a MAR project. We told you about water resource challenges and how, just checking to see if my mouse is working. We told you about water resource challenges and how MAR projects can help. That sets the stage for thinking about a MAR project and intended use. On the left, we list six water challenges that communities, regions experience. By implementing a MAR project, you can address one or multiple water challenges. These MAR solutions are captured on the right side of the slide. Note that we have identified case studies from the guidance document that will provide more real-life examples of these intended uses. Let's look at each of these MAR solutions a little closer in the next couple of slides. MAR can help provide water supply resilience for communities, agriculture, and industry, small and large, at a time of widespread groundwater depletion and increasingly dramatic swings between wet and dry conditions. Let me give you a real-life example. Today, about 90% of Scottsdale, Arizona, receives drinking water from two renewable surface water sources, the Central Arizona Project and the Salt River Project. Due to the shrinkage of available water, Scottsdale, Arizona has asked all residents and businesses to voluntarily cut their water usage by at least 5%. Also, about 1,000 people who live in the Rio Verde foothill suburb area had their water supply cut off by the city of Scottsdale on January the 1st, 2023. Scottsdale is implementing water supply resiliency by constructing four wells at strategic locations throughout the city as part of its commitment to maximize renewable water supplies and minimize the use of existing groundwater sources. This will ensure long-term water supply sustainability by recharging high-quality potable water directly into the aquifer when water demand is low, late fall and winter months, and retain the capability to withdraw groundwater during high demand or emergencies. In areas where regional scale groundwater level declines have resulted from long-term withdrawal rates that exceed the rate of replenishment, MAR has the potential to offset these declines and make additional quantities of groundwater available in areas where regional scale groundwater level declines have resulted from long-term withdrawal rates that exceed the rate of replenishment. This concept is known as water supply resiliency. This figure demonstrates water supply resiliency. You see treated water being injected into the ground for storage during periods of low demand, and then is recovered during periods of high demand. Let's see, I'm going to click one more time. Devin, can you help me? MAR can be used to improve the quality of groundwater in an area that may have water that does not meet drinking water standards. For example, harmful germs and chemicals can get into groundwater from many sources, including fertilizers, pesticides, or other chemicals that have been applied to land by farmers in septic sewage. Chemicals seep to the subsurface and degrade groundwater quality. What are some ways MAR can improve groundwater quality? Some projects inject treated or fresh water into a formation with marginal water quality to improve the native groundwater quality in the aquifer, whereas some projects have used multiple treatment processes to introduce water of quality compatible with the aquifer system while also providing treatment to meet the needs of the aquifer's intended use. A properly operating system would have a high recovery efficiency as a result of mixing of injected water, which may allow for recovery of a greater volume of usable water than the injected volume. Next slide. Saltwater intrusion is the movement of saline water into freshwater aquifers, which can lead to groundwater quality degradation. This occurs when storm surges or high tides overtop areas low in elevation. It also occurs when salt water infiltrates freshwater aquifers and raises the groundwater table below the soil surface. Saltwater intrusion barriers have been used to prevent saltwater intrusion to protect groundwater resources as early as 1953. For example, an area where a managed aquifer recharge project can make a difference is where freshwater aquifers near coastal areas in Florida are used to address municipal water supply, residential irrigation, and agricultural irrigation needs. Cities and towns, businesses, and agriculture draw much of their water supplies from aquifers, so it is important to protect the aquifers from experiencing any declining water quality. So looking at the diagram on the right, you see diagram A. It illustrates how an aquifer near a coastal area, a coastal location may appear under perfect conditions. Diagram B shows the effect of overpumping of the aquifer, pumping occurring there, which can cause salt water to be drawn inland towards the freshwater zones of the aquifer. Diagram C shows the use of MAR to mitigate salt water intrusion. It involves the injection of fresh water to reduce the inland movement of salt water. This positioning and usage of wells is known as salt water intrusion barriers. Flood-managed aquifer recharge or flood MAR can help reduce flood risk and boost groundwater supplies. MAR can also address storm water runoff by diverting water into permeable aquifers. To learn more about storm waters, see Section 3.1.4 of the MAR guidance document. For example, beaches in Hawaii, Florida, Myrtle Beach in California have issued no swim requirements at beaches due to poor water quality resulting from flood water, storm water drainage. Polluted water created from rainfall drainage and untreated sewage released into the water can expose swimmers to harmful microorganisms called pathogens. These pathogens can be present at or near the site where polluted discharges into the water. Flood MAR projects can better manage flood and storm waters. Let's use the diagram on the slide to visualize the intended uses of the flood MAR project. The flood MAR concept involves the collection of high flow flood waters and their conveyance downstream where they are spread across the land to, for example, support agriculture activities, recharge depleted aquifers, also known as enhancing water supply resiliency, and to improve water quality, among other intended uses. As you think about the concepts described here for Flood MAR project, I encourage you to see Section 3.1.5 in the MAR guidance document. Land subsidence is a gradual settling or sudden sinking of the Earth's surface. Land subsidence often results from compaction of compressible confined aquifer systems, both aquifers and confining units, resulting from overpumping of groundwater and the accompanying reduction of water in the aquifer. Some of the most drastic and best known of subsidence resulting from overuse of aquifers occurs in the San Juan Valley, California, where the land level has subsided up to 10 meters in the last 90 years due to overpumping due to drought conditions. This has caused the loss of levee freeboard and subsequent reduction in flood protection. A change of gradient along water conveyance canals, damage to roads and bridges, buried irrigation pipelines, land leveling of fields, and collapse of water well casings. Land is important because the valley is a big producer of fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Cattle and sheep ranching are also vitally important to the valley's economy. MAR projects are included in planning to reduce land subsidence by sustaining water levels in aquifers. MAR has been utilized to slow or stop land subsidence in many areas through the injection of water with significant success. Basically, the aquifer is being recharged to reduce or eliminate land subsidence with the added benefit of contributing to water supply resilience. Managed aquifer recharge is being used at several locations in the United States for ecosystem protection and stream flow maintenance. Drought and rising temperatures brought on by climate change, exotic species invasions, and human activities such as grazing and recreation all take a toll on riparian ecosystems. Without a healthy riparian area, land or structures that are too close to the water could be lost. When excess sediments are washed into the stream, the result is increased turbidity and deposition of sediment on the stream bed. Erosion and increased sediment from bank erosion may contribute to decreased water clarity and reduced visibility for fish to find food. The Sacramento River Valley has problems such as habitat loss, water pollution, floods, loss of native species, and other impacts of climate change. This has been caused because only 25,000 of the estimated 500,000 acres of riparian habitat that existed in 1850 remain today. The California Department of Water Resources is exploring opportunities to use MAR flood water for several purposes, including the protection of riparian ecosystems and replenishment of water streams in Sacramento River Valley, California. Now we return to the Walla Walla River Basin case study. The Walla Basin Watershed Council Water Challenge is a declining water supply due to an increase in development. The council is using various MAR technologies for intended uses of water supply, hold on, for water supply resilience. See? Protection of riparian ecosystems and maintenance of minimum stream flow. Now that we are back to the roadmap, I will turn the presentation over to Guy Sewell, who will now discuss the source water component of MAR.
Thanks, Linda. Good afternoon, everyone. We will now move on to a discussion of source water, which is the water that is intended for use as recharge. A variety of different factors need to be considered as we are trying to identify source water. In most cases, the availability of source water is the make or break component for the implementation of MAR. There's never enough water, so we're always on the lookout for potential source waters that meet both compatibility and availability characteristics. There are many potential waters that can be considered for source water with varying advantages and constraints in the context of the specific project. By far and away, the most common source water is surface water. such as lakes and rivers, as well as groundwater. We have other potential source waters, treated drinking water as associated with traditional ASR, highly treated wastewater, captured water, and flood water. Additional source waters can include industrial process water, such as cooling water, agricultural return flows, such as excess irrigation water. A potential future source may be treated, produced, or saline waters from oil and gas production. Other potential sources include dewatering systems, such as mining or construction sites, treated water generated from environmental remediation projects, and finally, in a few cases, groundwater transfer from one aquifer to another. As we talk about potential sources, availability is by far, again, the major issue that needs to be dealt with. So in context of both the volume and the duration of flow that need to be available from different sources need to be considered. For example, industrial process water may be very limited in the total volume, and sources like agricultural return flows may be limited in terms of seasonal availability. The next consideration is moving water from the area of the source water to the MAR project location. So the proximity and the availability of conveyances are also very important considerations and can have a significant impact on the design and cost of the MAR system. Other considerations is the ownership of the water or water rights. Again, this will vary from state to state and under different conditions. The ownership of the source water can be very straightforward or very complex. Potential competing uses and stakeholder concerns also need to be considered. And finally, there may be regulatory limitation on the availability of source water, even though the actual physical availability is there. Next, source water quality should be considered. Beyond the drinking water standards, there are additional chemical, biological, physical, and radiological characteristics that can potentially limit the availability or the use of potential source waters. So as we look at these different components of the source water system, the chemical makeup of the water itself can be important, such as with things such as emerging contaminants or disinfection byproducts. Biological hazards may be of concern. Physical characteristics that may be things like total dissolved solids or temperature, which can play a role. And finally, naturally occurring radioactive materials can be of concern. Ultimately, the pretreatment costs that are needed to address these different water quality aspects can be a significant impediment to the using of particular source waters. Depending on the MAR intended use, MAR project may need to meet federal and state specific drinking water standards. There may be additional design modifications depending on other federal and state requirements and the receiving aquifer characteristics. Regulatory issues are discussed in section 2.5, and water quality considerations are discussed in section 3.5 of the MAR document. Some other potential source water issues to consider might be the need for public outreach, environmental justice considerations, existing and future competing uses, ecosystem impacts, climate change considerations, characterization and pilot costs, and the need for a detailed conceptual model of the proposed MAR system. Let's look at the Walla Walla case study. In this case study, the availability of the source water and environmental considerations were addressed through a limited license from the Oregon Water Resources Department for water from the Walla Walla River. Conveyance of the water from the river was addressed using existing irrigation systems. And environmental considerations were addressed for this particular source water in collaboration with the Oregon Water Resources Department and stakeholders. Adam Jansen with Bar Engineering will now discuss the receiving aquifer component of the MAR model.
Alrighty, thanks, Guy. So as the name would suggest, you know, the receiving aquifer is what receives the source water in a MAR project, and this is where the benefits of MAR are realized. On this slide here, we lay out some topics here. These are all various characteristics of the receiving aquifer, various other considerations that you may need to take into account, either for the selection of the receiving aquifer or otherwise for the design of the project. Sometimes the intended use of the project dictates what receiving aquifer you have to use. And we'll see an example of that at the end of this section when we come back to the Walla Walla case study. So for the purposes of our training, we classify aquifers very simply into two groups, which are unconfined and confined. So definitely a simplification of reality, but appropriate for our purposes here. What really matters for a MAR project is whether the aquifer has a lid on it or not, because that has big implications for what the available storage is and also what recharge technologies are available for you to use. So the unconfined aquifer, which we see here on the left, does not have a lid on it. So the water table forms the top of the aquifer, and then we are able to infiltrate water from the surface through the vadose zone down to the water table. Now, on the other hand, the confined aquifer, which we see on the right, does have a lid on it. And so the lid in this case is this low permeability confining unit that forms the top of the aquifer that prohibits us from infiltrating water down through the surface into the aquifer. Another thing we have to contend with here with confined aquifers is that the water is under pressure. And so that's indicated here by the water level in this well rising above the top of the aquifer. So it's that combination of the pressurization and then the presence of the confining unit that prevent us from recharging the confined aquifer by gravity using infiltration-based methods. So the only way that we can recharge water into a confined aquifer is through injection. When we recharge an unconfined aquifer, as you see conceptually here on the right panel, what happens is we form a mound of higher water table near the infiltration site. So on our diagram here, we have our conceptual infiltration basin up here near the surface, and then water is percolating down through the vadose zone, which is what these squiggly lines indicate, and then it kind of piles up in this mound on top of the water table. So the height of this mound is a function of the hydraulic conductivity and the specific yield of the aquifer, and it's also obviously a function of the recharge rate. As you might guess, the depth to the water table is a really important criteria for MAR projects and unconfined aquifers, as this controls like what amount of storage is actually available. You know, if you have a case where the depth to water table is large, so the water table is very deep below the surface, then you have a lot of height available for that mound to form to then store that recharged water. But on the flip side, if you have a case where the water table is shallow, very close to the surface, you don't have as much room for this mound to form, and you can also start to run into some adverse impacts. You know, in particular, if you have this located in an urban or developed area and there are homes nearby, the mounding could cause wet basements. Something else that you have to consider that we don't show on the figure here is that there could be lenses of low permeability soils in the vadose zone that inhibit infiltration. And one way that you can get around that is using dry wells as your recharge technology. And that's something we'll talk about in the next section of this training. By definition, the saturated thickness of a confined aquifer is constant. And so when we inject water into a confined aquifer, as you see on the right panel here, we have to create space for that water through a combination of displacement of the water that's already in the aquifer. And then also there's some compressibility effects due to the increased pressure. The pore space expands a little bit and the water that's there compresses a small amount. As we inject source water into a confined aquifer, we usually form kind of a bubble of the source water near the injection well, and that's indicated by the darker shading on the right panel here. Now, the next three slides will go through some kind of various challenges or other considerations that you need to take into account when planning a MAR project that relate to the receiving aquifer. So starting here with site conditions and land use. It can be challenging to find enough available land to build the infrastructure that you need to do a MAR project over a particular aquifer. You know, that's obvious in an urban area where there's already a lot of development. You just may not be able to find parcels of land to build this infrastructure. But even in a rural area where it seems like there's a lot more land available, you still could have competition with other land uses like agriculture and oil and gas production. Moving to the upper right one here, it's tempting to think that a MAR project would always increase water quantity, but that's not always the case, especially if there are pumping wells installed as part of the project to recover that stored water. Existing aquifer users that have wells nearby could actually see reduced water quantity. Likewise, even if the source water quality is very good, there still could be degraded water quality impacts as a result of the MAR project due to geochemistry, which is something we'll talk about later in this section. And that's also a potential problem for existing users of the aquifer. We have a case study that we'll be talking about later from San Antonio, Texas, where existing users of the receiving aquifer were concerned about adverse impacts to both water quantity and water quality, and mitigating those impacts was a key component to the success of the project. Receiving aquifers or individual aquifers that you could use as a receiving aquifer may already be subject to administrative restrictions that are intended to either protect water quantity, quality, or both. One example of that is the US EPA's Sole Source Aquifer Program, which is designed to protect aquifers that are the only source of drinking water for their area from being contaminated. Kelsey said we're not going to talk about water rights in any detail in this training, and we don't in our guidance document either, but this is a place to at least mention that water use regulations, can be a very important aspect of a MAR project, and like those are on the state level, and they can vary quite a bit on a state-by-state basis. In particular, in many Western states, you have a responsibility to not adversely impact existing aquifer users, and so that's something that may limit what you can do with a MAR project. And then finally, groundwater contamination can be common, especially in urban areas. Obviously, we don't want to use a contaminated aquifer as our receiving aquifer, but there's also a liability angle to this that if our MAR project were located near a contaminant plume and it managed to increase the size of the plume by changing groundwater flow directions or gradients, then the MAR project owner could potentially be held liable for increased cleanup costs. So whenever we're making changes to the subsurface, especially changes to pressures, we may have to worry about geotechnical considerations. And so there's three that we're going to touch on here that we also discuss in our guidance document. So the first one is seismicity. Seismicity is defined as the prevalence of earthquakes in any particular area. And it's well known that deep injection wells for disposing of oil field brines or hazardous wastes have been linked to earthquakes. Now, there's underground injection control or UIC regulations for projects that use injection wells, and those may require you to do a risk for some kind of analysis of seismic risk. But we'll say that we're not aware of any MAR projects that have caused any earthquakes, and like the risk would appear to be much lower for a MAR project than for a deep disposal well, because MAR projects are usually occurring at much shallower depths and at much lower injection pressures. So related to earthquakes, here in the middle panel is liquefaction. Liquefaction is the technical term for quicksand. And this image here in the middle shows some soil that was impacted by liquefaction during an earthquake. What happens there is that the vibrations from the earthquake cause saturated sandy soils to basically turn to a liquid and just lose all of their strength. So obviously this causes catastrophic damage for any foundations or buildings, other infrastructure that are built on that soil. If we're saturating new soils as part of a MAR project in an earthquake-prone area, we could potentially be increasing the risk of liquefaction there. And then finally, our last panel here on the right is a picture of a landslide. And so changing the position of the water table on a steep slope can cause a slope failure or a landslide. And so the topography does need to be considered when choosing a location for a MAR project to be sure that the mounding that we would create as part of the MAR system wouldn't result in landslides. So geochemical compatibility isn't something that causes issues for every MAR project, but when it does, it really can be a deal breaker. The issue here is that there's already water in the receiving aquifer, and it may have a very different chemistry than the source water that's being added to it. And then the mixing of those two waters then could incite some chemical reactions that could have some very adverse impacts that we list here on this slide. So the first one to talk about is fouling of the injection well screens. And this is a very common problem for injection wells. And this four panel figure kind of illustrates that progression over time, starting from a brand new well screen up here in the upper left, and you see the slots in it where the water enters the well from the formation. But then over time, you know, due to the chemical conditions here, we start seeing corrosion of the screen until finally we get to this lower right panel where it's gotten very rusty and then the slots have gotten plugged up. So there are some O&M operations and maintenance considerations associated with injection wells that you may need to clean them periodically to combat this. Now, it's not just the screens of the wells themselves that might get plugged up as part of a MAR project. This can also happen to the aquifer matrix itself. And there are a couple of different mechanisms here that we list which that can cause that. The first one is precipitation of minerals. So if we mix the source water and the native groundwater in the receiving aquifer, and that causes precipitation reactions that then have solids coming out of solution and then plugging up the pores in the aquifer, you know, that really reduces the permeability and the storage available for water and increases the injection pressures required to run the system. In addition to precipitation, we also can clog up the aquifer by interactions with clay minerals. And so especially if we change the salinity of the water, that sometimes causes clays to swell or disperse and then plug up the pore space. And that can be an irreversible process. Besides clogging of the aquifer, we actually can go the other way too and cause dissolution of the aquifer matrix, where the solids actually get dissolved into the water. This is mostly an issue with carbonate aquifers that are sensitive to acids. And so if the pH of the water becomes low enough, you could see the aquifer start to get dissolved. And then finally, the last one we list on here, it's a very important one that has bedeviled several MAR projects historically, which is the mobilization of naturally occurring contaminants, and especially arsenic. And so under the chemical conditions, especially the redox conditions in the receiving aquifer, you know, arsenic may be present, but it might be bound to the surfaces of the aquifer matrix. And so it's not in the water. But once we mix the source water, which often contains oxygen, whereas the water in the aquifer does not, those reactions may cause the arsenic to then go into solution, and it'll be in the water that gets produced by the pumping wells if we're extracting that water, which is then a problem. We do have a case study in the document, I believe it's number 5.2, that talks about a potential way to mitigate arsenic mobilization in MAR projects. But, you know, because of how serious some of these adverse impacts can be, it's very important to characterize the chemistry of both the source water and the receiving aquifer as part of the planning of the project, just to identify what issues may be possible and come up with a plan for mitigating them before they derail the project. So modeling is one of the primary methods that we can use to forecast the performance of a MAR system. And it's especially important for groundwater related projects like this because we can't see the receiving aquifer. Like, we don't know what's going on down there. And so modeling is one of the ways to try to help us understand what is happening as we run the system. We can use modeling in a predictive sense, you know, to try to forecast, you know, how a system might operate. And that's what this graphic here shows. These are images from a groundwater flow model showing, you know, where does the recharged water go once it gets into the receiving aquifer. And so you see this progression over time as these flow paths move away from the injection site. And so in this particular case, this aquifer has a very strong westerly flow gradient. So as we put the water in there, we watch it mainly flow to the west. We can also use modeling to support regulatory submittals. And so this would be actually, these results here were conducted as part of a permit application for a new system. Once the system is operational, we can use modeling in an interpretive sense, especially if things aren't going as planned, to try to help us understand what's happening and what we can do about it. And then finally, modeling is great for communication to project stakeholders and try to explain how the project works and, like, you know, how we expect it to operate. So let's take a minute here for a poll question. So Devin, if you want to go ahead and open the poll, please. Which of these topics here is not a potential challenge that's related to the receiving aquifer? And so your choices are A, the mobilization of naturally occurring contaminants, B, artesian conditions, C, degraded water quality for existing aquifer users, and then finally D, increased risk of liquefaction. And so we'll keep this open here for probably about a minute or so, at least until the responses kind of start to slow down. All right. I could see the answers here. I couldn't see them as they were coming in. But yeah, so we have most people answered B, and that is correct. So artesian is just a word that's basically another term for a confined aquifer. Artesian just means the water in the aquifer is under pressure. So it's very common for MAR projects to use confined aquifers. So that's not a challenge, whereas the other three were all things that we covered on the preceding slides. So that's good. And then finally, the last part of this section is we're going to come back to the Walla Walla case study and talk about the receiving aquifer. So the receiving aquifer for the Walla Walla project is an alluvial aquifer that's part of the Milton Freewater alluvial fan deposit. So alluvial is an adjective that just means it's a deposit that was created by flowing water. And so in this case, the Walla Walla River comes out of the Cascade Mountains in this area, and then it deposited this sand and gravel aquifer over time. This is an unconfined aquifer, and because of that, they were able to use infiltration basins as the recharge technology, and all these red markers here on the map indicate the locations of the recharge sites for this project. Now, a big reason why they selected this alluvial aquifer as the receiving aquifer is because it's the one that's connected to the streams. You know, and as Linda told us, one of the intended uses of this project was to augment stream flows, and so they were only going to do that if we use the aquifer that is the one that's connected to the streams. And that brings us to our next roadmap slide. So now that we've gone through the source water and the receiving aquifer components, Jeff Davis from Integral Consulting is going to tell us how to put those two together and what recharge technologies you can use to get that source water into the receiving aquifer.
Let's see here. Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay, hey, thanks, Adam. Appreciate it. You know, recharge technologies are a suite of methods used to recharge the receiving aquifer that was just discussed. In the MAR document, we have chosen to subdivide these technologies by the receiving aquifer type, confined or unconfined aquifers. The confined aquifers generally use injection wells, and the unconfined aquifers tend to have a little more variety with infiltration basins, retention structures, dry wells, and infiltration galleries. As you can see from the diagram, the lower boxes highlight the intended use of each of the recharge technologies that's discussed in the earlier spans for improving groundwater conditions, to protecting riparian ecosystems, water supply resilience, and to mitigate seawater intrusion. We'll first discuss infiltration basins. There are a lot of different names to describe infiltration basins, such as circulation ponds, spreading basins, recharge basins, and rapid infiltration basins. The primary objective, however, is the same, and that's to passively infiltrate water to an underlying aquifer. Operation of these basins could occur throughout the year or over a shorter period of time. Infiltration basins generally require an aquifer with infiltration storage capacity that can accommodate the required objective or scheme. They can also vary in size and can range from a very small channel to large basins. They're also generally considered less expensive than other recharging methods, although a basin may get clogged over time, which may require removal of an upper layer, such as drying and scraping of the surface, to revive the basin's infiltration capacity. These infiltration basins also are generally less regulated for water quality due to the passive nature of the recharge scheme. The next one up is hold on a second. Let's see, did I skip one here? Yeah, injection wells. Sorry about that. So the next one up is injection wells. I also want to note that an injection well can also be called a recharge well. Injection wells directly recharge the aquifer. They can also be used to mitigate saltwater intrusion or subsidence. They often require a more intensive investigation. That's typically because of a variety of reasons, including water quality, to make sure that the source water is compatible with the native water. The depth of injection wells can vary substantially. Clogging of the well is common and tends to require backflushing or some other mitigation to prevent loss of recharge capacity. What's really nice about the injection wells is that they have a very small footprint. So they can be used in places where there isn't a lot of land, such as in urban environments. Injection wells can be really expensive to construct, operate, and maintain, in addition to requiring a skilled operator. Injection wells also can be used to recover stored water. These wells are referred to as aquifer storage and recovery wells, or ASR wells. So next we have retention structures. Retention structures are typically impoundments constructed to retain water as they move along a natural channel to promote recharge of the aquifer. They may be a dam, a dike, a levee, or some other kind of embankment that captures surface water and runoff. They tend to be implemented in locations where infiltration rates to the aquifer could be substantial, and there is no significant impermeable layer that exists, which may create unintended flooding. While retention structures can be cost-effective because they use the natural landscape, their application can be limited. So now we're going to talk a little bit about dry wells. Dry wells are gravelly fed excavated pits. They are cased or lined and backfilled with materials such as gravel or stone. They can penetrate layers of soil with poor infiltration rates. They can also be used to offset the effects of stormwater on for aquatic ecosystems. But now dry wells are growing in popularity as MAR, Managed Aquifer Recharged, approaches to augment groundwater supply. Dry wells can be cost-effective compared to other MAR technologies. They have a similar footprint than, they have a smaller footprint than, say, big infiltration basins, but they also need regular maintenance to address clogging. The recharge capacity is highly dependent on the hydraulic connectivity of the surrounding soils. There may also be state and federal oversight due to the water quality concerns. So our last one here are infiltration galleries. Infiltration galleries are similar to dry wells, except they're typically consist of perforated pipe installed horizontally under the ground within permeable fill material. What this does is it allows for rapid infiltration of stormwater runoff, and they're used to prevent flooding and support groundwater replenishment. Types of infiltration galleries include French drains, lateral drains such as engineered channels, pipelines, or other structures developed to divert water into the ground. They may be federal and state regulated to reduce potential contamination. These kind of galleries also may clog and are susceptible to intrusion by plants. They can be placed near the surface or at deeper depths, and the land above can be developed for other uses. Okay, let's see if you were paying attention here. Poll question here, Devin, if you want to put up. And the question is, the reason why injection wells may be preferred recharge tech, maybe the preferred recharge technology are A, land is expensive and the water quality requirements are easier, or B, injection wells are inexpensive to build and surface infiltration is too slow, or C, the receiving aquifer is confined and the footprint for injection wells is small, or D, injection wells are more likely to win water sustainability awards. So we'll give it a few minutes. Hopefully you were paying attention. Hey, Devin, how are we doing? Wow, look at that. 82% picked the right answer. The answer is C. The receiving aquifer is confined and the footprint for injection is small. Okay, cool. Okay, so going back to our case study, the Walla Walla Basin. Infiltration basins and galleries were used in 19 recharge sites in the Walla Walla watershed. What's really unique about this particular location is that it crosses both the Oregon and Washington border. So there's a lot of collaboration that's been involved in order to get this project up and running. They developed it under a phased approach, which allowed an evaluation of a cost benefit and then a way to support the project for the long term. This phased approach is still occurring, but they've been able to recharge over 51,000 acre feet since 2004. Not all of the recharge basins operate each year. The Walla Basin Watershed Council used MAR in the Walla Walla River Basin watershed to restore aquatic habitat on the Walla Walla River for the steelhead and the bull trout, and also to encourage and improve the water flow in the river and in the streams. To accomplish this groundwater mitigation, it was required to redress the groundwater that was declining in those conditions in the alluvial aquifer of the Milton Freeway aquifer and the seepage loss from the river to the groundwater. Water from the Walla Walla River provided that source water. Using existing irrigation delivery systems, water was conveyed from the river to multiple infiltration galleries and basins located throughout the alluvial aquifer to recharge that aquifer. So in that Walla Walla project, the aquifer maintains a high degree of hydraulic connectivity to the streams, which is important to restoring the aquatic habitat. The project first tried to restore stream flow through conservation, but ultimately it was determined that there was so much connectivity between the groundwater and the surface water that without increasing the groundwater levels, they weren't able to meet the targets for restoration. The collaboration and development between the landowners and the local nonprofit is already in place. So although their target hasn't been met yet, they're still on track to eventually meet their objective of annual recharge of 20,000 acre feet per year. So now we're going to stop here and see if there's any questions.
Indeed. All right. Thank you, Aaron. Jeff, I'm just going to pause really quickly to take remote control so we don't advance any slides by accident. So at this time, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod and we will answer any questions for our training live. And then we will continue on with some content and then we will have another Q&A at the end of our training today. So with that, we have a few questions already in the Q&A pod here that I'm going to read out loud. This is a general question of who owns the MAR project of the Walla Walla case study. Jeff, I saw you came off mute.
Oh, I was gonna see if Linda's probably the best person to answer that one.
Okay.
I believe it's the Walla Basin Watershed Council.
And the information should also be in the guidance document online, I believe, in terms of the background for that case study that goes more in depth. Which I can put the link to that in the response here in just a moment. All right. We have a few questions to some specific trainers here. Kelsey, this first one is for you. Referring to the part of your presentation that said the loss of floodplain function due to the channelization and flood control, the question is, are you talking about natural channelization here? If not, what were the design oh my gosh, I'm sorry, considerations of channelization in Walla Walla?
We were talking about natural channelization here.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, Linda, the next question is for you. What is the distance between injection and recovery wells at Scottsdale, Arizona? Saltwater intrusion depends on several parameters, but confining material play a good role here. In your example in slide 15, why was the injection well shown next to the saltwater source instead of pumping well? Is that based on the groundwater flow direction in this particular case? And I know that was a big question, so I'd be happy to split it up for you, Linda, if that needs to be.
Yes, could you split it up? Thank you, Devin.
Yeah, so the first part is what is the distance between the injection and recovery wells for Scottsdale, Arizona?
I don't have that number. I'm sorry. That's the
Okay,
same
no worries.
number.
And then for saltwater intrusion, usually it depends on several parameters, but confining materials generally plays a role. In your example on slide 15, why was the injection well shown next to the saltwater source instead of the pumping well?
Why repeat the last part of that question one more time? I didn't
Why was
write.
the injection well shown next to the saltwater source instead of the pumping well? And I can also go back to slide 15 here for reference.
Oh, okay. I think I yeah, you can go back, but I if I had to think, you want to recharge the aquifer. And then some of the benefits from recharging an aquifer is not only to prevent saltwater intrusion. Sometimes an added benefit is that you create an additional water source that can still be used for pumping. So the injection well is placed in front of the pumping well. To continue to create pressure in the aquifer to prevent saltwater intrusion in sea. And it also, the added benefit, you've got added water. So there's still pumping water for water usage in the area. Hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you very much, Linda. All right, our next question is directed towards Adam and Jeff. The attendee is looking for an example on dry well for recharge technology when their length is not that long and when they are installed for different purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you an example of that. When we were doing work in, the Harris County, which is like where the city of Houston is, and we were looking at getting rid of floodwaters, Dry wells is a great option to look at if you can't get that water to go down the very close to the surface. It just provides a mechanism because those dry wells are usually pretty large in diameter and they just get that water down far enough, deep enough, and quick enough. So that's a pretty good example. And typically, you're not confined or constrained with that really heavy water quality requirements like you would on a direct injection well, which is going much deeper. So hopefully that answered his qu that person's question.
And I'll add that there's another case study in the guidance document number 5.8 that's all about dry wells. And that another consideration was just, the space available. If you don't have room for a large infiltration basin, the dry wells are a much smaller footprint and can be a more attractive option.
Yeah, and where was that? Do you remember, Adam, where that case was at?
This is in Merced County, California.
Okay, California.
All right, thank you, Jeff and Adam. We have time for one more question, and then we will have to move on to our content just to make sure that we are on time today. So our last question here for our trainers, what are some of the technical considerations for MAR to combat brine intrusion from deeper in the Michigan basin into a confined bedrock aquifer? Overpumping in the bedrock aquifer is causing the brine intrusion.
Yeah, Jim, I think this one sounds, it's similar to a saltwater intrusion problem, where the idea is that you want to try to create a buffer, of lower salinity water between where you're pumping it and then where it's, intruding in from the saltier part of the aquifer. But I think, challenges could be just can you get wells in the right places and how many of them would you need to do it? And then what water can you get to then inject in there to generate this buffer? That already, if it's over pumping from this bedrock aquifer, yeah, what other sources of water do you have to build that buffer?
All right, thank you very much, Adam. So, with that, just to keep in time with our logistics here, we will have one other opportunity for questions and answers, but we will move on to the next section, which I believe is our first case study example, led by Guy Sewell.
Thanks, Devin.
Take it away.
Let's see if I can click here. There we go. Thank you. Our first example case study is the Sustainable Water Initiative for Tomorrow, or SWIFT, in the Hampton Roads, Virginia Sanitation District. And pictured in this slide is the $25 million SWIFT Research Center that was built in 2017. The image that you see is of Eastern Virginia and roughly encompasses the Hampton Roads Sanitation District, which serves about 1.7 million customers in 18 cities and counties and treats 250 million gallons a day of wastewater. So SWIFT is an innovative water treatment and managed aquifer research project designed to enhance the sustainability of the region's long-term groundwater supply and further protect the region's environment. The project will help address environmental challenges such as Chesapeake Bay restoration efforts, sea level rise, and saltwater intrusion. At full scale, SWIFT will be implemented at up to five HRSD wastewater treatment facilities with a total recharge capacity of up to 100 million gallons per day. By the way, the strange-looking object in the center of the figure is the Chesapeake Bay impact crater, which occurred about 35 million years ago and still has profound impacts on groundwater and surface water systems today. As we have mentioned, modeling projections are an important component for successfully implementing a MAR project. In this slide, we see a projection of 50 years out in time for the impacts on the potentiometric surface. The relative impacts on groundwater on the groundwater table over a 50-year period, both with and without the SWIFT system being implemented at the 100 million gallons per day level. On the left-hand side, we see a reduction in the pre-development water table of as much as 70 meters. On the right-hand side, with the injection plan, or at least in this model, we see quite a bit of mounding. The influence of the discontinuity of the geological layers due to the impact crater can be seen in the center of the image. As we consider the intended use of the SWIFT-MAR project, we see a variety of different drivers. Probably the most important in terms of available funding sources is the water quality aspect of Chesapeake Bay. On the other hand, Potomac Aquifer is also the major source of water for several million people in the area. Decreases in the water table in this coastal region aquifer come with its own predictable set of problems, including both subsidence and saltwater intrusion in this coastal region. In this particular case, we are also looking at protecting the long-term economic growth of this area by providing additional water supplies. For SWIFT, the source water is highly treated wastewater from the Hampton Road sewer districts. In this MAR application, there are both traditional water quality goals and advanced treatment for nitrogen and phosphorus in the system. The SWIFT project tested two competing treatment trains, a carbon-based treatment system and a membrane-based system, and decided to go with the carbon-based system based on performance. The addition, the advanced water treatment component is one of the major cost considerations for this project. And this diagram shows the complexity of the treatment system that's been implemented for the project. The state-of-the-art nutrient removal wastewater treatment facility is followed by a carbon-based treatment train before the SWIFT water is recharged to the Potomac aquifer system. The water is treated by several processes, including coagulation, flocculation, sedimentations, ozonation, biofiltration, granular activated carbon, UV, disinfection, and pH adjustment. This system is both technically challenged and closely monitored for water quality before the water is put into the aquifer. The estimated capital cost, upfront cost, for the proposed 100 million gallon per day capacity is $2 billion, or about 55 cents, or about 5.5 cents per gallon of water. Shown in this table, the SWIFT project is addressing the typical regulatory limits for treated wastewater in addition to concerns about some of the geochemical interactions with components of the aquifer matrix. The Potomac aquifer system is a confined aquifer with interbedded clays and sands. It's more than 1,000 feet thickness in some locations. The typical TDS of the water is from 700 to 7,000 parts per million. With secondary drinking water standards set at 500 parts per million, this creates some challenges in terms of getting regulatory approval to inject water that is both compatible and will support the long-term performance of the injection system. Injecting relatively fresh water in order of magnitude lower the ionic strength than the native groundwater reduces the surface charge on interstitial clay minerals residing in the sand matrix of the aquifer. Inner particle attachments weaken due to the change in surface charge and diminish adhesive forces between the individual clay layers, causing clays to disperse. Fragmented clays can collect in aquifer pore spaces, dramatically reducing aquifer permeability. Clogging due to migrating clay fragments is a special type of formation damage that can permanently limit recharge operations. Here's a schematic of the Potomac aquifer system, and as you can see, it's quite a complex system. The fall line on the far left is where natural recharge occurs. The major extraction zone is more toward the center of the figure, depending on which of the particular units of the Potomac aquifer system we're accessing. There is some connectivity between those units, but it is a semi-confined to confined system, depending on where and which of the layers you're looking. In the SWIFT project, the highly urbanized and highly priced land in the area, along with the confined nature of the Potomac aquifer system, required the use of direct injection technology. Again, the pretreatment must address both traditional water quality aspects, but also geochemical compatibility issues to make sure that we don't mobilize any of the clays. This system has gone through injection and flow testing, and they have already addressed some of the plugging issues with certain approaches to back flushing. SWIFT is a very ambitious and ongoing MAR project. This is a site schematic of the SWIFT system, and you will notice the injection wells and the monitoring well location. The infrastructure located in the lower left is the traditional wastewater treatment system. The SWIFT advanced water treatment system is in the bottom center, of the image, and this is located along the James River. The system provides direct injection to a maximum depth of about 1,000 feet. This schematic demonstrates how the injection well accesses multiple layers in the upper, lower, and middle Potomac aquifer system. You can see about 300 feet of screen and about 1,000 feet of total depth. This is a very large and complex injection well. It's one of the biggest injection well systems I've come across in my experience. So this is an ongoing and developing project, and the goal is to reach the 100 million gallons per day level by 2026. I'm not sure exactly how far along they are at this point. Some additional challenges have occurred. As mentioned earlier, PFAS is kind of throwing a wrench into some of their plans, but I believe they're moving forward. This project is very large and complex and shows an example of using highly treated wastewater as the source water, direct injection as the recharge technology, and a complex coastal confined aquifer as the receiving aquifer, with the goals to improve water quality, increase water resilience, mitigate saltwater intrusion, and land subsidence. Okay, I think we've got a poll question now. So our question is, what was the source water component of the Swiss MAR project design? A, Chesapeake Bay water, B, treated wastewater, C, desalinated seawater, or D, surface water? And as we can see from the results, most of the people, 74%, selected the correct answer. Remember, this system is using treated wastewater, and the fate of wastewater is the primary driver for the formation, or at least for the design of the system. Remember, we're talking about a huge amount of treated wastewater in a highly urbanized environment because of its impacts, even post-treatment, on surface waters in the area. So this is a very large, complex project, which I've mentioned more than once already. I think one of the key factors is dealing with a large amount of wastewater, which makes it somewhat of a unique project of the available case studies that we've got. Okay. Next, Adam is going to discuss the next case study. In the MAR document, case study 5.4, the San Antonio Water Systems H2O Center Aquifer Storage and Recovery Project.
All righty, thanks, Guy. So the San Antonio Water System, or SAWS for short, is the water utility for Greater San Antonio, Texas. And currently, SAWS gets about two-thirds of its water from the Edwards Aquifer. But as recently as the 1990s, that was 100% of its water. And since that time, they've made some big investments to try to diversify their water supply and, you know, develop other surface water and groundwater sources. But one of the reasons that, you know, they've worked to do that is because since the mid-1990s, withdrawals from the Edwards Aquifer have been regulated by the Edwards Aquifer Authority. So this Edwards Aquifer Authority was created in response to a lawsuit that alleged that overpumping from the Edwards Aquifer was harming endangered species that depended on springs that were fed by the aquifer. And so one of the things that this Aquifer Authority has the power to do is to curtail pumping during dry years in order to maintain the flows at those springs. And so that creates somewhat of a challenge for SAWS in that they have a fixed allocation of water that they're allowed to pump from the Edwards Aquifer each year. Now, in wet years, they don't need all of that water to meet their demands. But these unused allocations don't carry over from year to year. So if they don't use it all in a wet year, they just lose their rights to it. But then in dry years, when they wish they could have their full allocation, it might get reduced depending on what's happening at those springs. So it's a difficult situation for them trying to make sure they have enough water at the time that they need it. So that sets the stage here for a poll question. Devin, if you'd like to open it, please. Let's do a little role playing here. So imagine that you're in San Antonio's shoes and that you have excess water from the Edwards Aquifer available to you during wet years. What would you do with that water? And so the four choices that we have here are A, just don't pump it, leave it in the ground if you don't need it. Option B is to produce it, but then discharge this water into a surface water reservoir to try to store it for later. Option C is to pump it, but then inject it back into the ground into a different aquifer to store it. And then finally, option D is to pump it and then try to sell it to a different water provider, maybe make some money off of it. So I'll give you a little bit of time here to think about what you would do in this situation. And then when the responses start to slow down here, then we'll reveal what Saws actually did. Ooh, split responses here. Okay, so we had 43% chose A, so it was don't pump it, just leave it in the ground. We had 16% said option B, to pump it but put it into a surface water reservoir. It was about neck and neck here between A and C. C, 39% said inject it into a different aquifer after pumping it, and then only 2% picked D, which was pump it and sell it to a different water provider. So the topic of our training here probably suggests what the answer is for what Saws actually did, and that is option C, which is pump it, but then inject it into a different aquifer. So option A, wasn't maybe in their best interest. As I said, these unused allocations in the wet years don't carry over to subsequent years. So if they don't pump the water, they lose the right to pump it. If you pumped it and then put it into a surface water reservoir, like option B, you would lose some of that water to evaporation. So maybe not the best option. And then option D, if it's a wet year, you may not have a market for that water, selling it to a different water provider. But option C here is the correct one. I mean, on first glance, it may not seem like it makes sense to pump water out of the ground and then just put it right back into the ground, but it's the regulatory structure here that actually does provide an incentive to do this. And this is one of the reasons that we picked this case study for the training. It's just because it's unconventional in that groundwater is the source water. So we'll step through the four pieces of the MAR model here as they apply to the SAWS case study. So the intended use, starting with that for this project, is water supply resilience. Effectively, what SAWS is doing here is creating a bank account where they make deposits during the wet years, and then they have withdrawals during the dry years. And that's illustrated on this figure, which is a time history of the operation of the system. The horizontal axis here is time. So this starts in 2004 when the project went online, and then this figure goes through June of 2019. The vertical axis on this figure is volume of water in acre feet. And then you see zero is in the middle. So the positive numbers on the top of this figure are times when their system was pumping water back out of the ground. And then the negative numbers on the downside from zero are when they are injecting water into the ground. And so you can see on here, there's a lot more of these spikes and shading on the bottom side of this figure than there are on the top. So that indicates that overall, this system has created a net storage of water in the time it's been operating. They've put more water back into the ground than they've taken out of it. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the source water for this project is groundwater from the Edwards Aquifer. So the Edwards Aquifer is shown in blue in the shaded region there on the figure. You can see it goes right through San Antonio. The Edwards Aquifer is a very important aquifer in Texas. It's a limestone aquifer that has some karst features, so springs, large caverns, fractures. It's very close to the surface in San Antonio, but it gets a lot deeper as you move to the northwest because the formation dips in that direction. They're lucky that the Edwards Aquifer has excellent water quality, so it's really good stuff as it comes out of the ground, and that means that they don't need to pre-treat the water before they re-inject it, other than they do disinfect it before it goes into the receiving aquifer. The receiving aquifer in this case is the Carrizo Aquifer. That's shown in red here on the figure. It's located a little to the southeast of the Edwards Aquifer in San Antonio. The H2 Oaks facility, so the Aquifer Storage and Recovery Project, is located at this black dot here in the southeastern corner of Bayer County, which is the same county as San Antonio. So at that location, the Carrizo Aquifer is about 400 to 700 feet deep. And compared to the Edwards Aquifer, the water quality is not as good. It has very high dissolved solids, iron, and manganese, and then the pH is a little bit on the low side at 5.5. Now, I mentioned there, though, the location of the project is right in the corner of the county. And like, this wasn't just to make sure that it was in the same county as San Antonio to keep it close by. There was a other strategic component to this from a regulatory standpoint. And that is within Bayer County, the Carrizo Aquifer is not regulated. But if they had gone on either of these two county lines into these two, in one of these two adjacent counties, in those locations, the aquifer is regulated by a group called the Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District. And like that, would have had additional restrictions for the project. But this there was more to this that I'll get to in a few slides when we talk about stakeholder engagement. And so kind of to rehash what they're doing here, we're taking water out of the Edwards Aquifer and then putting it into this Carrizo Aquifer. And they're doing that using aquifer storage and recovery, or ASR wells. So these are a special case of injection wells. These are wells that, they can inject water into the ground, but then you can also flip them around and then use the same well to pump water back out of the ground. The map shows that so far SAWS has installed 29 ASR wells, and the locations are shown here. The total group has a capacity of about 74 million gallons per day that they can inject into the ground. And then each individual well can pump about 1,000 to 2,000 gallons per minute back out of the ground when they need to produce the water. You can see this is a big area, but the footprint of each one of these individual wells is pretty small. And so that allowed SAWS to then lease the land above this storage reservoir for agricultural use. And that was an important stakeholder engagement piece, that they weren't coming in here and just taking all this land out of production. Their footprint here is pretty small. Like, they just need access to the aquifer under the ground, and like, what happens on top of the ground can be pretty much the same as it was before. There are some lessons learned for this project with regard to appropriate materials for the wells. They've run into issues with corrosion. They initially used 304 stainless steel for pumps and screens, but found it wasn't resistant enough to corrosion over time. And so they've been retrofitting wells with 316L stainless steel, which is more resistant to corrosion, but it is quite a bit more expensive. They also had trouble with the original well casings were made of an epoxy-coated steel, and it was difficult to prevent damage from occurring to that epoxy. And then once it gets nicked, then the casing underneath it can corrode when it comes in contact with the water. And so now they use a high-strength, low-alloy steel in place of the epoxy coating. So stakeholder engagement, as I alluded to earlier, was a really important factor for ensuring the success of this project. So there were quite a few private well owners that used the Carrizo Aquifer for their water supply in the neighborhood of the H2 Oaks project. And they were concerned about both reduced water quantity and degraded water quality as impacts from the H2 Oaks project. When those ASR wells are pumping water back out of the ground, there will be a large cone of depression created from that. And some of these nearby well owners were concerned that, their yield of their wells would be reduced, during a time when the system was pumping. And I mentioned earlier that the quality of the Edwards Aquifer water is excellent, so putting that into the ground isn't going to cause a contamination issue. But people were worried that, well, what if San Antonio decided to use something like treated wastewater instead of the Edwards Aquifer water? That might make our aquifer water quality worse. And so, some of these residents were concerned enough that they did get a referendum on the ballot to try to annex this area where H2 Oaks is located into that Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District in the neighboring counties. But the referendum failed. But despite that, SAWS entered into negotiations with Evergreen to be a good neighbor. And in 2002, they reached an agreement. And so to mitigate the concerns about water quantity, there's a limit on how much of the native Carrizo aquifer water that SAWS is allowed to withdraw when their system is pumping. So obviously they're allowed to pull out all of the Edwards aquifer water that they put into it, but because a little bit of that of the native water is going to mix with that as they pump it back out, there is a limit that they're only allowed to withdraw 6,400 acre feet per year of the native water. And so then that preserves the water in the aquifer for the other residents to use. To mitigate the concern about water quality, SAWS did agree that they will only use Edwards aquifer water for this project. They can't use any other types of water for source water. And then going beyond this agreement, SAWS also developed a monitoring and mitigation plan for some of these private wells that were nearby to assess whether they might be impacted from the project and like what they could do to mitigate those concerns. And so they went through and surveyed 166 wells to see whether they might need to lower the pumps to make sure that they will still be able to pump even when the H2O system is recovering water. In some cases, they couldn't lower the pumps in wells. And so either they had to drill an entirely new well, or in places where public water systems were available, they connected these homeowners to public water systems and then abandoned their wells. Neat preview there, but this slide here is a nice summary of the H2 Oaks project. So since it's been operating, since it started operating in 2004, through the end of 2022, you see it has stored a net total of 189,000 acre feet of water. So acre feet, kind of a weird unit, but that's equivalent to 1.1 billion gallons of water. And so that's a very nice reservoir that they have available to them now during dry years when their Edwards aquifer allotment could be curtailed. So overall, this project has definitely been successful at achieving its goal of water supply resilience. And then we'll wrap this up here with a poll question. So Devin, if you could open that, please. Which of these four options was a concession that SAWS had to make to existing users of the Carrizo aquifer? And so your choices are A, they can't use treated wastewater as the source water. B, not allowed to extract any native Carrizo groundwater. C, SAWS has to replace all private wells in the area with public water supplies. Or then D, H2 Oaks got annexed into the Evergreen Underground Water Conservation District and then was subject to their regulations. We'll give you a little bit of time here to answer this. So these projects are very complex and then a lot of things going on. So we'll see if you picked out the right one here from all of these different factors. Alrighty. So 50% picked option A, which is the correct answer. Treated wastewater was not allowed to be used as source water. So SAWS had to agree that they would only use the Edwards aquifer groundwater as the source water. And so the other ones, though, that they're not allowed to extract very much of the native Carrizo groundwater, but there's still a little bit they're allowed to pull out just to account for mixing. SAWS did replace some private wells with public supply, but that was not a requirement for all of them. And so there was a referendum to try to annex them into this Evergreen Underground Conservation District. They did not actually get annexed, but they did work with Evergreen to reach an agreement that was acceptable to all parties to allow them to move forward with their project. So that wraps up our H2 Oaks case study, and I'm going to turn it back over to Kelsey to wrap up the training. Thank you.
We're going to go back one slide. Okay. Thank you so much, Adam. And thank you all who continued with us throughout the entire training. We're happy that you stayed with us. So, what did we learn today? As you can see from the unconsolidated sedimentary aquifers of the SWIFT project in Virginia to the karst bedrock aquifers in Texas, managed aquifer recharge is a process and not just a simple formula or a linear flowchart. Depending on the need or the problem you are facing, you can start anywhere on the MAR model. This training has also showed that MAR is adaptable as well as applicable to a wide variety of aquifer systems. Regarding the Walla Walla Basin watershed, the future is now for MAR. We saw that commercial development threatened the Walla Walla River flow rates and lowered water levels so that the ecosystems for bull and steelhead trout were threatened and needed protection. Specific stream flows had to be maintained and water supply resilience was needed. These were the intended uses of this MAR project. Since the Milton Freewater Alluvial Fan was a highly conductive receiving aquifer, recharged via infiltration basins and galleries, as shown above by the Johnson Aquifer Recharge Site, would provide the source water to feed and maintain water levels in the primary and secondary rivers in the Walla Walla Basin watershed. A total of 19 recharge projects were implemented across both Oregon and Washington to put water back into the aquifer. The solution for the Walla Walla Basin watershed could not have been accomplished without stakeholder engagement from both states. You already saw how important community engagement was between counties in the SAWS project in Texas. We didn't have time to cover these today, but here are some things to consider when developing a MAR project. Section 2 in the guidance document is dedicated to project planning, including stakeholder engagement and regulatory considerations and permitting. Modeling plays a big role in planning a MAR project and is discussed in detail in Section 3.6. Appendix B defines water quality parameters, including physical, chemical, biological, and even radiological. Appendix C provides state, territory, and tribal regulatory contact information. We hope your understanding of managed aquifer recharge and how it can be applied is clearer to you after today's training. Take the time to dive into the fact sheets provided in the guidance document, as well as the 9 other case studies to determine which solution might work for your need. All right, Devin, I think it's time for questions.
All right, thank you very much, Kelsey. Let me just stop remote control here. Okay, so at this time, we'll look to the Q&A pod for our final Q&A, and then we will wrap up the webinar with some logistics. So our first question for our trainers, are there treatment contingencies for emerging contaminants such as PFAS or 1,4-dioxane as examples? I will offer that ITRC does have an emerging contaminants team, just as a shameless plug, that does work on a framework for anticipating and dealing with emerging contaminants. Trainers, I don't know if we have any perspective on it in terms of managed aquifers and groundwater and so forth, but if not, we can move on, and I'd be happy to refer you to that new team, which they did just produce a guidance document and does also have a training, as well as focusing on biologicals in 2024. It doesn't look like we have any bite. Yeah, Linda?
I don't think the MCLs have been issued yet for the MCL. The MCLs have been issued or been approved yet for the PFAS constituents. And so at this point, unless, you know, there may be some state requirements, but at this point, it probably would be project specific if there are some contingencies put in place, and it could be put into place for various reasons. Hopefully that answers the question, Deb.
Thank you very much, Linda. All right. next question. How are, sort of goes with that, so excuse me if it was already answered, Linda, but how are PFAS being addressed to ensure that SWIFT is going forward? Are PFAS being reinjected?
I'm not sure we have the most up-to-date, but logically, because they're using the carbon treatment train approach at a high level of efficiency, that's probably kind of the default system at this point. And again, as Linda pointed out, we really don't have some of the regulatory guidance on this thing. So if your question is, are PFAS being re-injected into the aquifer? Yeah. But the question that should be a risk-based question in terms of what level. I think their existing technology is about as good as you can do at this point. But again, I haven't really seen the latest information on that particular aspect.
All right, thank you, Guy. In your experience, trainers, are there concerns with things like pharmaceuticals and even caffeine?
I think it's important to remember, for the most part, MAR applications where water supply is the intended outcome, it's still raw water. So your question about what we're looking at in terms of treatment downstream is the same issues you would have with any water source. And remember, there are a variety of other objectives just beyond water supply.
All right. Thanks again, Guy. Next question is directed for Adam, but I welcome any responses from additional trainers. What are the biological water quality conditions for Edwards Aquifer, which require disinfection prior to injection? Are these data available on the ITRC guidance document?
Yeah, so I just looked up. So the San Antonio Water System has a nice website for the H2 Oaks project, you know, just data about their water system. And I don't see an answer for sure. And like, I don't know about, you know, what biological constituents may have been there that may require disinfection, but this is just me speculating. But because the Edwards Aquifer is a karst aquifer, you know, water can travel much faster through large caverns and fractures than it can through a porous media aquifer. And so it may just kind of be a conservative protective approach, you know, just knowing that water can get very quickly into a karst aquifer from surface water. And so, like, you know, you may have to kind of treat it as if it were surface water, which would require disinfection. But I said, that's, I don't know for sure if that's the answer or not, but you know, you can look up SAWS and like the H2 Oaks project online, and they have a good website that might have more information for you.
All right. Thank you very much, Adam. Our next question is directed for Jeff, but again, trainers, you're welcome to add to in responses. For Jeff, PFAS was plugged in CERCLA in September 2022. How are RCRA sites groundwater wells handled with the PFAS? Is PFAS treated with GAC at this moment?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is going to be on a state-by-state basis. Nothing's come out yet for the RCRA standards, but, you know, we're expecting that. So when it does, it probably is going to create a whole bunch of mess. Activated carbon isn't the only way that PFAS is being treated. There's other mechanisms as well. So, I mean, the states that have remediation sites, that definitely is a concern. But if it's related to managed aquifer, where you're putting that treatment back into that treated water back into the ground, Generally, that's going to have to be, if you're directly injecting it, it's going to have to be treated to ground to drinking water standards. So, yeah, it's getting complicated with not just PFAS but other emerging contaminants.
All right, thank you very much, Jeff. Our next question. Typically, it's been prohibited to interconnect aquifers through wells screened in multiple aquifers. How did the SWIFT program get regulatory acceptance for injection into multiple aquifers?
Typically, the prohibition on that interconnected, it has to do with extraction to limit the mixing within those different formations. In this particular case, we're actually putting water back into the system. And I think, I'm somewhat hesitant, not really, to speak for the state of Virginia, but I think they probably have identified that the benefits outweigh the cost in this particular case.
All right, thank you very much, Guy. So with that, that concludes our question and answer portion of the training. So I have a few logistics for everybody as we end the webinar here. Again, we do have feedback forms available, and that is how you would get a certificate of completion for the course as well. Those are going to be available on the Clumin training page that brought you to our MAR webinar today. You need to just fill it out, click a box to certify that you participated, and a certificate will be emailed to you. We would like to extend our gratitude for all the questions asked today. If you would like any further clarification, or if you have any further questions on the topics of anything that we presented today, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. Our trainer's information is also posted on the Clumin webpage, and you are welcome to reach out to them directly. I would also just like to say a special thank you to our attendees for joining us today, and a very special thank you to our trainers, our expert trainers that joined us, and our backup trainers as well for supporting this event and our first MAR webinar. We are very pleased to be here, and hopefully we will see some more of you in some future ITRC trainings. So with that, I would just like to wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and thank you very much.